Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We need to take a holistic view of Australia's relationship with the region, because when it comes to having influence in ASEAN, it's important to consider not just the security traditional concerns, but equally the non-traditional side of things.
Now we could definitely see Australia willing to take a more proactive role in shaping and, of course, contributing positively to the security of the region.
I think it's more likely there will be no ASEAN rather than an ASEAN with a unified answer to a geopolitical situation like you mentioned.
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights, and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Rory Medcalf, the head of the National Security College at the Australian National University. It's a pleasure to welcome our listeners this week to an episode focusing on Australia's relations with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, with ASEAN, our Southeast Asian neighbours. And of course, this is very much in recognition of the week of ASEAN engagement here in Australia. In fact, we're recording this podcast in Melbourne, where the ASEAN Summit and side events are underway. So we're recording from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and I pay respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging as the custodians of this land. It's great to have three guests with us who are all specialists in the geopolitics, the security, the foreign policy, and indeed the societal challenges of Southeast Asian nations. Three of the many experts from across the region who've converged here in Melbourne this week for the academic and think tank side events to the high-level summits. The three guests I have with me in our Melbourne makeshift studio are Dr. Pishamon Yopantong, who is the head of research at the Centre for Future Defence and National Security at Deakin University, working out of Canberra. Great to see you here, Pishamon.
Thank you very much.
We also have Dr. Huang Litu, repeat guest here on the National Security Podcast, but wearing not one but two relatively new hats in your career, Huang. And of course, you're the Deputy Director for Asia with Crisis Group. But congratulations also on your very recent appointment as Chair of the Advisory Board of the Australia-Vietnam Policy Institute.
Thank you, Rory. Good to be back.
And finally, we have Don McLean Gill, who's a lecturer from De La Salle University in the Philippines. And of course, Don, it's going to be great to have your perspective, not least because of the historic speech to the Australian Parliament last week by President Marcos. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Professor. It's a true honour.
So let's get underway. There's a few dimensions of the topic I'd love us to address in the next little while. And the first, of course, is the ASEAN Summit here in Australia. The fact that Melbourne's having its marvellous moment of diplomacy, and that not only have leaders from ASEAN countries descended on Australia, but very substantial delegations of officials and also experts. And this is a time for the Australia plus ASEAN, if you like, multilateral engagement, but also a whole variety of bilateral meetings where I think some very serious strategic and other issues are being discussed, plus the side events that we've been involved in, which are also important, dialogues for emerging leaders, dialogues on maritime security and so forth. So there's a lot of diplomatic action, colour and movement here in Australia, but what is the significance during this time of great uncertainty in world and regional affairs? Pishamon, I might go to you first for your take on why is all this diplomatic activity in Melbourne this week so important?
Well, it's important because it really showcases how Australia is taking the region seriously and how hopefully this signals Australia's even deeper relationship building with ASEAN as an organization, but equally with individual ASEAN member states. I think it's these types of events that really help to solidify not just the government-to-government relations, but equally the people-to-people relations as well. And we've already seen how active the inclusion of, you know, academics like ourselves, but equally of civil society, of businesses, and that is a good part of what the Australia-ASEAN relationship needs to be made of.
And just before I go to Huang to get your take on this, I guess since this is your first foray into the National Security Podcast, I'd be interested to know what's the perspective that you bring to looking at Southeast Asia and ASEAN issues?
Well, thank you for that. And I promise not to say too much about myself, even though that's always a temptation.
Please do.
Well, I have to say, I started researching in earnest about ASEAN and, you know, individual ASEAN countries, specifically Mekong countries, so Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Myanmar, Thailand, of course, was because of the China factor. So I've been looking a lot in my own research about Chinese investment, Chinese economic statecraft in this region, what it means in terms of the influence game, as people often like to refer to it as, but equally what it means from a non-traditional security perspective. So if anyone looks me up, you'll see that I do a lot of work in the environment space, climate change space, but equally in the governance and human security space. And so for me, we need to take a holistic view of Australia's relationship with the region, because when it comes to having influence in ASEAN, it's important to consider not just the security traditional concerns, but equally the non-traditional side of things. So that's where I come from in terms of my interest in this region. And of course, I'm Thai.
So of course, and look, I think there's dimensions here that will all be brought out, I hope, when I bring the conversation a bit later to talking about what are the big challenges and opportunities ahead for ASEAN. Huang, a little sense of, I guess, where you're coming from perhaps, and then beyond that, I'd love to hear your take on why this week's diplomacy is so important.
Thank you, Rory. I'm coming from my interest in Southeast Asia comes from really personal background, because I was born in the post-war Vietnam, but pre-Doi Moi reforms. So it's the darkest period, I would think, because it was the most isolated period when Vietnam had really almost no relationship diplomatically, was under embargo, had no connection with outside world other than obviously the Soviet world, which soon crumbled and left Vietnam really isolated. And so for me as a kid, I was always interested in outside world, because that's something was a blanket for us. We didn't have access or connection. And so it took upon myself as a research interest, and then it became my profession really in terms of international relations and security studies later on. But really, Vietnam has gone through such a transformation, integrating with ASEAN itself, opening it to its neighbors, and in making amends with in some of those neighbors where on the other side during the Cold War, and then expanded to global relations with global powers. And now at this point, not only Vietnam integrated with ASEAN, but many Southeast Asian neighbors look up to how Vietnam maneuvers diplomatic relations, not only with major neighbor that next door that it has a lot of dispute with, China, but also how it maneuvers with other powers, including relatively new relationship with very complicated US. The Prime Minister of Vietnam now promotes the idea of bamboo diplomacy, but that just shows you how Vietnam, from very isolated and very rigid country, become such a popular, but also relatively successfully maneuvering this most challenging geostrategic space.
And how do you see the broader significance of the ASEAN summit this week? And if you want to refer more to the Vietnam context, feel free.
Oh, the summit is excellent. I mean, if you ask any leaders or any people from Southeast Asia if they want to go to Australia, you know, Australia is one of top destination to gather, to study, to visit. So I think Australia has really strong soft power asset there. So you see a lot of delegations, more than you would normally expect from ASEAN Plus Summit. Usually, if we see ASEAN, let's say ASEAN US Summit or other ones, a bit further away, it's relatively short, relatively to the point, and the delegation don't tend to be that big. But this week is massive. Also for Melbourne, also for Australia side, but all the delegations from Southeast Asian countries are really, really keen, very enthusiastic. They bring a lot of their officials, ministers, but also a lot of business community leaders. So I think it does reflect the enthusiasm that a lot of Southeast Asian countries have towards Australia, and then vice versa, how Melbourne so beautifully hosts this big event. And just to back up this example, we just had a delegation from Vietnam with Prime Minister leading a huge delegation of ministers and business leaders, signing new MOUs, announcing new flight routes, Melbourne to Hanoi. And so there's just so much more of connection and so much more appetite to enhance the relations and also lift it up to the next level, hopefully soon to be announced. But yes, it's a good energy, I would say, from the summit. There's a lot of this appetite for collaboration, not only from policy circle, but also you see presence of business and exhibitions of business and companies. So that was really engaging and bringing participants from various background. That was quite enriching in the discussion, I thought.
Look, thank you, Hong. And I'm not going to buy into the question of whether Melbourne is always the best place to hold a major multilateral event in Australia. I know that Taylor Swift had her own views, but let's not go there. Don, let's go to you instead. So, Don McLean Gill, your perspective, it'd be interesting to understand where you as a scholar operating out of the Philippines come from in seeing the regional foreign policy and security dynamics, but also your take on why this week is important in diplomacy.
Thank you very much for that, Professor Metcalf. And of course, coming from the Philippines, I was born and raised in the Philippines. I'm a Filipino citizen of Indian origin. And of course, it is quite interesting, and I've been studying the region, the country's foreign policy for quite some time. And it is very important to understand how the Philippine position towards the region, coming from a Filipino perspective, is actually quite dynamic. And it has often faced significant challenges in terms of pursuing a linear or consistent approach. And therefore, as each administration comes by, there's obviously something new that we need to look into towards Manila's perspective for the region. But of course, other than that, it is very much important to locate the Philippines not only in Southeast Asia, but within the Indo-Pacific construct as well. And this is, I believe, one of the greatest opportunities for the Philippines to really demonstrate its agency within this geopolitical region, and where the Philippines is often confined itself to be a small state in Southeast Asia. Now there is a lot of potential, a lot of momentum under the leadership of President Marcos Jr. To solidify the Philippines as a middle power of the Indo-Pacific. So my work as a lecturer, as a director for South and Southeast Asia at the Philippine Middle East Studies Association, we're trying to link Southeast Asia to West Asia to South Asia, and of course reorienting particularly the Philippine position throughout the greater Indo-Pacific really holds a lot of significance for events such as this. And this goes to your next question regarding the significance, my take on this particular summit. Well, of course, from the Philippine perspective, there is, of course, a growing recognition of Australia's importance, not only to the Philippines, but also to ASEAN. Whereas traditionally speaking, decades back, Australia was often looked at based on public opinion as a provider of aid, of loans, etc., of benefits, economic benefits. But now we could definitely see Australia willing to take a more proactive role in shaping and, of course, contributing positively to the security of the region. And this is, of course, very much important at a time when the current administration in Australia and the current administration in the Philippines are highly convergent in their perspectives and visions for the greater region. So I believe the timing is perfect, the situation is perfect, the Philippines willing to work with its Southeast Asian neighbors, but also look at other alternative options beyond the region. So this provides a significant avenue.
And I think I'd love to come back to that a little later on in terms of the more confronting aspects of the Philippines' strategic situation in the region as well. The fact that certainly in the maritime differences with China and the way that Chinese forces have been behaving towards the Philippines, there's obviously a major friction point we need to engage with. But let's bring the conversation to the broader array of challenges and opportunities ahead for ASEAN, because I guess as someone who's been around ASEAN diplomacy for a long time, early in my career as a diplomat, for my sins, I was involved in setting up Australian policy on the ASEAN Regional Forum, for which many people probably won't forgive me. But I've seen, you know, I've seen the challenges of ASEAN diplomacy reasonably close, the fact that there is so much process, the fact that consensus building and consensus maintenance is so paramount, and the fact that that is often at odds with the pace and scale of the challenges that the region's actually dealing with. And so it's very difficult to maintain a realistic perspective on how to make ASEAN work. And yet, I think we all can agree, it's a good thing that it exists. Look, I guess with reference to your own areas of interest and expertise, it'd be great to know what you see the challenges and opportunities are for ASEAN looking ahead. Pishamon, I'll go to you first.
Well, firstly, Rory, I probably wouldn't be so hard on yourself with respect to your complicity in setting up the ARF. But to your question, so from my perspective, it's the non-traditional security side of things that matter a whole lot to me. And that's in large part because it's what, you know, an everyday ASEAN person has to contend with, right? The challenges of climate change, the challenges of insufficient support when it comes to social protections. If you're a worker, for instance, especially if you're a migrant worker, it's all those range of issues that ASEAN as a whole has been trying to move on, and yet we often see incremental or very little change. And of course, to an individual who is a survivor, let's say, of forced labor or human trafficking, it's just not enough at this stage, the progress that ASEAN has made. But as you rightly noted, dialogue is an important part, plays an important part in all of this. And it is important that ASEAN continues to have conversations, but also tries to have implementation of the conventions, of the agreements that are in place to protect the peoples of the region. And all of this is to say that in view of the announcements that have been made over the course of the past 2 days, so on the 4th, yesterday, Penny Wong made an announcement to do with the Mekong Australia partnership that there will be continued substantial funding going to that program. And the focus will be on water security, enhancing climate resilience, as well as fighting transnational organized crime. And all of those areas are areas where Australia and ASEAN and individual ASEAN member states have had a fairly longstanding track record of cooperating with one another, including in more sensitive areas like intelligence sharing and information sharing. And is certainly representative of the swathe of non-traditional security issues that ASEAN countries continue to face and oftentimes have very little resources to support. So I think this is one example of where continued Australian commitment is really useful, but also where we need more action, not just at the state level, but equally at the local level, to really bring these types of programming down to the level of the communities who stand to be most impacted by the adverse impacts of organized crime, of climate change, and to ensure that their voices are also represented in future events, should there be a next summit, Australia-ASEAN summit next year, for instance. Another area, if I can quickly touch on it, was announced, I believe, might have been earlier today. My dates are all, I have no sense of time anymore, let's just say.
I think it's Tuesday.
Yeah, I think it is Tuesday, isn't it? But there was an announcement earlier as well, where it was said that Australia is going to now commit, I believe, $2 billion to a Southeast Asia investment financing facility. And that Export Finance Australia will be playing a key role in all of that. And of course, there's a comparable facility in the Pacific. And one of the issues that myself and other colleagues working in the space have touched upon before is about how we have to ensure that the investment is going into sectors that are of greatest need to Southeast Asian countries themselves. So we need to ensure that there is a continued focus on a needs-driven approach. But it's also important to ensure that the investments that Australian businesses are engaged in are climate resilient, but also meet the requirements of international human rights standards, and to ensure that there will be no adverse human rights implications stemming from those investments. Because there was some issues before in relation to the Pacific financing facility. Some of those have been proactively addressed, but we need to ensure that they don't happen again. And similarly, with the announcement of the partnerships for infrastructure, I'm probably getting the name wrong. That's another area which is something that I, for one, will be looking very closely at. As we all know, infrastructure is a huge area of growth for ASEAN countries, and the infrastructure gap, according to the ADB, continues to grow as well. We need $1 trillion worth of investment in this sector to ensure that ASEAN countries can pursue sustainable development, right? But we also need to ensure that large-scale development projects do not come at the expense of whether it be the environment or the people themselves. And so, again, I feel Australia can play a very constructive role in not only ensuring that there is much needed resources flowing into these areas, but equally to ensure that the normative standards are being upheld and to ensure that, you know, that Australia helps to raising the bar when it comes to these issues.
We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In a volatile world, Australia's strategic problem demands difficult decisions. Licensed by an inclusive conversation. The ANU National Security College is proud to present Securing Our Future, a conference like no other, informing a distinctly Australian, people-centred vision of national security. Bringing together diverse Australian and international voices, we are bridging disciplines, professions and viewpoints. Join us in Canberra on the 9th and 10th of April this year to engage with thought leaders and decision makers from government, academia and industry. For more details and to secure your ticket, visit the link in the show notes. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
Look, I'm glad you've raised that that question about particularly about development finance or infrastructure financing, because you know there's obviously a follow-on from what Australia's been doing in the Pacific. There's also, I guess, a question of how much is this part of the the contest regarding influence with China's role in the region, and what role can Australia realistically play with others, not in outright competition with China, but in providing those options and those alternatives for development when the need is so great. And I think it's worth us reminding the audience in terms of the scale of the need, the population of the ASEAN countries, we're talking hundreds of millions of people. I think a few of us were quizzed yesterday in the conference about what percentage of the world's population it is. I think the answer was 8%, if I recall. But there's a large proportion of humanity in the region, very different levels of development, diverse cultures, and much of Southeast Asia is really prone to environmental risk. So I think it's really worth reminding our listeners of the scale of that challenge, and that no one country can meet that. So Hoang, from your perspective, what is the, you know, what are the challenges and opportunities ahead for ASEAN?
ASEAN, I think first of its challenge is to stay relevant. I think it has had some successes despite many criticism. It has successes in the past, but it's not entirely sure how to replicate and continue it going forward. So a little bit of context that when it was established, it didn't have much chance. Not many people believe that ASEAN will last 50 more years. I mean, there have been a number of attempts at that point between Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, or Seattle even. A lot of initiatives that didn't really last, didn't stood the test of time.
And five countries, late 1960s, Vietnam was actually certainly not part of it in those days.
That's right. That's right. The original ASEAN countries. So for them to get together and not only succeed in that very challenging geopolitical environment was the deep Cold War time, and not only succeed past Cold War, but integrate and expand to 10 now. We're now talking about the 11th member as well. To be really creating this new notion of region, what is a complete Southeast Asia, right? For a long time, we talk about 10. Now we'd be talking about 11 soon. But I think that is also its contribution, which need not to be neglected. And all these norms, creation, preventive diplomacy, all the things that ASEAN celebrate, and some criticize it for too little in terms of effect, but too much effort or taking too much time. But that's the culture of ASEAN. It's primarily to build trust. And perhaps it takes a long time to build trust among the neighbors. And perhaps they're still in this phase to build confidence among each other before they can move on to real deep cooperation, as many would want to see. But I think for ASEAN, the region, it is ultimately still an intergovernmental institution. So it is going to be reflecting the nature of governments and policies around. And not that much has changed around in Southeast Asian politics and leadership. Mind you that many of political leaders remember the very original ASEAN time. They won't let go to the next generation. And a lot of time, next generation is not interested enough. Or, we can talk about Thai politics as well, but it's complicated, as Facebook would say. But a lot of time, even newer generations belong to certain dynasties across the regions that also comes with certain legacy. So there is a way of how politics work in the region, and certain habits, rituals, behavioral patterns are not going to change anytime soon. And there is a lot of ritualistic in ASEAN, the way we celebrate, the handshake, the anthem you didn't like, but a lot of this recognition.
Just as a record, it wasn't me that didn't like the anthem. It might have been someone.
Yeah, it was me. I really dislike the anthem, and I still stand by what I said. It's not a good anthem.
But in Australian, I remain neutral on that subject.
But I just wanted to say that it is like ritual, which is like Christmas or Lunar New Year. We all don't really like it. It's a lot of burdensome because there's a lot of expectation, but we carry on because it's part becomes a part of identity, a tradition, and tradition do change from time to time, but it takes time and only certain elements of that would change. So for ASEAN, I think that this tradition of being very slow, consultative, and very, very safe will remain in the foreseeable future. And that is both its, strength and weakness. And I think it has learned to live with it.
But we do have to get to the question, maybe not immediately, but certainly before the end of this conversation, of how sustainable is that in the event of a regional strategic crisis. But maybe we can come back to that in a moment, Hoang. Please go ahead if you want.
No, certainly there are opportunities too, right? A lot of risk, but I think we can go deeper into that. But my short answer is that don't expect a unified position, answer, or even attitude within ASEAN. And it's not, I think it's more likely there will be no ASEAN rather than an ASEAN with a unified answer to a geopolitical situation like you mentioned.
Yeah, and I'm thinking obviously what happens in a, whether it's a conflict across the Taiwan Strait or another major strategic breakdown.
The only consensus would be we remain neutral and uninvolved as much as possible. That is what is safely to assume that is going to be common response and calling everyone to restrain and diplomacy.
So on that confronting note, let's go to you, Don. Challenges, opportunities ahead for ASEAN.
Right, thank you. So when we look into the challenges of ASEAN, we have to, again, look at ASEAN based on the historical context, which is often overlooked, surprisingly, in this particular day. So ASEAN's creation in 1967 was based on the idea of not integration, right? But it was based on the idea of a risk-averse, survival-driven initiative by the founding members of Southeast Asia. And of course, at the heart of the ASEAN way is, of course, the preservation of sovereignty. And sovereignty remains the most important element within ASEAN. Now, having understood that, we are obviously expecting a lack of a unified approach on key issues within ASEAN. I think that this was present in the past and this will continue on in the future. But however, we have to understand that the ability of Southeast Asian countries, despite located in such a tumultuous geopolitical region, as my distinguished colleague has mentioned, that, you know, for it to be able to survive up to this very, you know, very long time frame is very much important. However, given the context of contemporary geopolitics, we are looking into the pressures that ASEAN is facing from within and, of course, from outside. When we look at it from outside, of course, we could look into the burgeoning power competition between the US and China and how that is creating fault lines within ASEAN. And that, of course, limits ASEAN's ability to navigate, collectively in this regard. And we have seen this time and time and again with the first veto in 2012, if I'm not mistaken, for a joint statement by ASEAN, which was unprecedented. And of course, in 2017, there was this desire to remove the 2016 arbitral ruling from the joint statement, despite the pressing issues in the South China Sea. So these are, of course, the challenges that we are going to face. However, there are also opportunities. There is a realization between and among Southeast Asian countries that it is difficult to depend on particular powers, and of course the need for a homegrown initiative to at least alleviate the tensions to a significant limited degree is necessary. And we have seen this with a joint maritime drills, despite the fact that it was relocated. This is of course still an important decision by ASEAN to pursue this, and of course in line with this, Southeast Asian countries have differing threat perceptions, and to get all of them on board, despite their individual sensitivities, is of course very important. But of course, the challenges will continue to exacerbate, especially as the structural conditions are also facing a lot of turbulence. And this is, of course, which centered on your previous question, Professor Metcalf, on the need to reconsider. Should there be a cultural change within ASEAN, a structural change, despite its difficulty? Well, these are, of course, the questions that are continuously being asked even between ASEAN countries. And we've seen this with Myanmar, for example, where there were initiatives that went out of the ASEAN framework but were also pushed back. So, of course, we are looking into this. And, of course, with the situation in Taiwan, for example, while ASEAN will try to remain neutral, of course, there are some countries like the Philippines that are bound by a treaty with the United States. And this, of course, removes that neutrality from our position. We can't be neutral. But of course, we would still have to navigate that based on our persistence within that ASEAN framework. So this is where the challenges but the opportunities come out of.
And thank you so much, Don. Those points really open up a few other lines of inquiry, which I'll just touch on briefly. One is, of course, the question of flashpoints and the fact that not only in terms of a Taiwan confrontation, the Philippines has the alliance with the United States, has the proximity to the potential theater of conflict. There would presumably be US military access or even basing from the Philippines involved there, but also flashpoints within the South China Sea, whether it's to do with the Philippines-China relationship or others with China. Do you have a sense, and I'll sort of push you on this for a moment, Don, of the expectations in the Philippines regarding other ASEAN countries in a crisis? Would there be an expectation of solidarity? Would there be a realism about the kind of neutrality that Wong has spoken of? Or is this a story that is yet to be developed?
Thank you, Professor. And in fact, that's a very timely question, because if we look into what Manila is currently looking at based on its regional prospects, you know, there is a growing recognition in Manila that, of course, there are diverging perspectives within Southeast Asia. And it is likely that what we are currently doing, our proactive position of safeguarding our sovereignty and sovereign rights based on international law, engaging with extra Southeast Asian powers in order to keep our seas open and inclusive, of course.
Protecting your fishermen from harassment apart from anything else.
Exactly. Is also looked at quite warily by some Southeast Asian countries. However, we have recognized this and we have tried to, of course, look at a common denominator, such as, for example, if I may give one example, the Transparency Initiative. While the Transparency Initiative aimed to expose Chinese belligerents within Philippine EEZ, harassing our fishermen, our Philippine Coast Guard vessels, we have also tried to relocate the focus of the Transparency Initiative to socioeconomic reasons, food security, etc. And this is, I believe, our way to get other Southeast Asian countries on board. But of course, it's a long shot, so we're trying to make that balance as of now.
And this is, I guess, just a small insight into the, I guess, the depth and the range of thinking that is going on in the region about these prospects. Before we wrap up the conversation, I want to go to Australia, if you don't mind, because we began this conversation very much with the National Security College basically ambushing you all here in Melbourne to say, let's get together and talk about the ASEAN summit and what it means. But of course, the cause of this gathering is very much the Australia-ASEAN relationship. And I think for all of the talk about Australia being effectively in some way alienated from its region, the very fact that successive Australian governments now have been able to maintain this closer relationship with ASEAN, I think the first of these summits was convened under Prime Minister Turnbull in 2018, and now we have the whole summit coming to town in Melbourne under Prime Minister Albanese. It's a really important signal for the Australia-ASEAN relationship. What are the, I think, realistic ambitions and limitations of that relationship, Pishamon?
That's a great question, and I feel it's the question that everyone is asking at the summit as well. It's important what we discuss right here and now, but it's even more important to contemplate what the future holds and how we can all work together to ensure that the future is a more stable one. I would say, kind of going on from what's been discussed so far, I feel like one of the key terms is competition. It's inevitable that we are stuck in a great power competition between the US and China. And indeed, the prospect of a future Trump presidency would be one that further exacerbates that rivalry. And I feel from based on the issues that I've been looking at, we need to ensure that that competition doesn't result in a race to the bottom in many ways, whether it be in terms of undermining the rules-based order, when it comes to, you know, issues to do with human rights and good governance, noting, of course, that in the U.S. right now, there is a lot of concern, right, in relation to human rights and the rule of law even. So we won't want to see that cascade into the ASEAN region where, you know, a lot of concerns have already been raised by civil society and indeed even by businesses and governments themselves of what social instability would mean for the region, but also human insecurity. We also have to ensure that the race to the bottom doesn't happen because Australia, in view of Australia's foreign policy, wouldn't want that to happen, right? It stands in opposition to the values that Australia holds dear.
And this is where I feel Australia can play a big role. It can play a role in relation to standard setting. Let me go back to the example of infrastructure financing. You know, Japan, the US, they have the quality infrastructure initiatives. That's something that I know Australia has been very interested and has been pushing forward in this region as well, and something that needs to continue. We don't want for the competition between Australia and China when it comes to infrastructure financing or development financing more broadly to result in a situation where those who need that development are the ones worst off at the end of the day. And we need for Australia to be very vocal on these issues, obviously in a way that is politically nuanced and sensitive, but nonetheless to not cede ground and to ensure that Australian businesses, for one, are doing the right thing when it comes to enhancing human security and progressing the sustainable development goals of countries in this region. I know it's a laundry list that I can go through, really, but I really wanted to spotlight how when we talk about competition and when we think about geopolitical risk, and this was something that I raised at our session yesterday, right, in at the Emerging Leaders Dialogue track, that it's not just about the security issues, the traditional ones. Of course, the South China Sea and the prospect of conflict over Taiwan are very pressing and very, very concerning, but those aren't the only strategic geopolitical concerns that individuals have within ASEAN. For people in the region, you know, their day-to-day lives are most impacted by the realities of climate change, by the realities of precarious work, and many other of those non-traditional security concerns. So for Australia, if Australia wants to have an even amplified, more amplified impact in this region, that is where Australia can work with ASEAN as an organization and the individual member states, and reach for the what are often referred to as the low-hanging fruits of non-traditional security cooperation. They might be low-hanging, but their impact can be profound, not just in relation to the future survivability of states in this region, but equally for Australia's own security, because as we all know, it's all interdependent at the end of the day.
Wong, what's your sort of sense of ambition, but also realism for Australia-ASEAN?
I think there are many reasons that Australia and ASEAN can work together and should work together closely, more closely even so. And I think we mentioned one just now with a potential of what if Trump comes back or what happens in America post the election. And I think that common sense of anxiety binds Southeast Asia and Australia together as countries that will be affected in one way or another, should the changes be in Washington that not necessary to what we would like to see or we would be comfortable with. And we've started the conversation with how divided ASEAN is. But if Trump comes back to America, the United States of America will be even more divided. It will actually widen the gap in societal division. And that's not what the region wants. You know, it wants a strong, united America that is clear what it wants and what is its interests and what it can achieve with the region. But the more divided America is, the less confidence in it from regional actors and partners. And I think at this juncture, Australia offers quite a sense of stability. And its engagement with the region has been consistent. I think it's been on more positive trajectory since this new government. And I think the messaging...
Almost 2 years now, not so
well,
new.
Not that new, but yes.
People still say it's new, though.
That's good. You have a sense of freshness, which is, you know, you're not tired of it just yet.
Forever so. Young. Okay.
So it's a good assessment. But... You know, just the fact that the Prime Minister and Foreign Minister went to the regional capitals in very first weeks and months, it's also a part of ritual. It's also part of ASEAN culture.
And to that respect, right?
Yeah, it is. It does give that recognition. And then the sense of consistency is more important than anything. Australia's next door. It's going to be next door for the next 50, 10, 100 more years. And it should...
Probably some millions.
Well, yes, if we see any movement in continents. But The fact that it's consistent and has a policy, it has awareness that it is a part of the region, it wants to and deepen relationship with the region is I think well received, and that it will be valued in spite of changes of the government in Southeast Asian countries. And I think that that sense of continuity and consistency is very important. In terms of what is realistic, I think there are many things that each of us can give a long list of laundry list what is important to us, climate, technology, and financing and economy. But I think there are many things that are happening across the world and regardless of borders. We are all experiencing climate change. We are all experiencing technology revolution. We are all in building this cyber norms, AI norms. Everything is changing so fast. Governments don't have answers to everything. And I think if Australia and Southeast Asia can work together, even in setting standards and norms in infrastructure or tech, it will benefit everyone, right? And it's not about one what Australia can do for Southeast Asia or what Southeast Asia can do for ASEAN. For ASEAN, it is what we can do all together to make life of citizens better of each country. So I think there are common goals there. So I think that's that positivity should be not forgotten, because we're too in many discussion we're too anxious about what China and US brings, forgetting that life continues to develop and we need attention to that as well.
I think we Australian Foreign Minister likes to talk about agency, and I get a strong sense in this conversation that there's a fair bit of enthusiasm for that idea in Australia-ASEAN relations. Don, the last word to you.
Right, thank you. And you know, just to add on to the excellent points of my respected colleagues here, we have to understand the opportunities for Australia first. And of course, Australia's position in Southeast Asia is non-controversial. It has no strategic axe to grind, and it's looked at in a favorable position, right? Of course, under the current administration, there is this desire, at least, to present Australia not merely as an extension of the U.S.-China competition, and that is a member or a part of a bloc politics strategy, but of course, as you've mentioned, Professor, its own agency within the region. And this is, of course, the desire of Australia to position itself as an alternative, as an option for Southeast Asian countries, and we've seen how it has tried to balance its position as well between the US and China. So that's very important signaling in terms of being able to work with individual ASEAN countries. And that in itself is very important and would allow Australia a more holistic set of foreign policy options and tools vis-a-vis its Southeast Asian neighbors and not just in a selective position. So of course, we're looking at it from that perspective. So we're made with a good start. And of course, there is this ability of Australia to also work with other like-minded partners, not necessarily to be looked at from a U.S.-China perspective. So Australia, Japan, and India, for example, worked on a trilateral supply chains arrangement. But of course, there's still so much room to be maximized for such like-minded countries to work further to provide for Southeast Asian countries and from a wide array of issues. So I think that's very important. But however, when it comes to what else Australia can do to strengthen its position in Southeast Asia, I believe that there is a need to focus also on economics. Economic cooperation lies at the heart of each Southeast Asian leader's national policy. And of course, foreign policy in Southeast Asia is also largely intertwined with economic development. So of course, while Australia position in the past few years could still not be comparable to Japan or China, of course, but at least there's this desire with a strategy published a year ago, if I'm not mistaken, or 2 years ago, regarding an economic plan for Southeast Asia. So that in itself is a step in the right direction. So I think Australia has the right tools, but it's all about maximizing it amidst these turbulent times.
Yeah, and I think I would note that Nicholas Moore, the author of that strategy, spoke to the Emerging Leaders Dialogue that you're all involved in yesterday as part of ASEAN Week here in Melbourne. Look, thank you again to our three expert speakers. And I think although we all met yesterday in the so-called Emerging Leaders Dialogue, I know that these are very much voices that have emerged in deciphering regional geopolitics and security and economic challenges. So thank you again to our three guests on the National Security Podcast for making sense of the Australia-ASEAN relationship and the opportunities and challenges ahead for Southeast Asia. Pishamon Yeopantong, Huang Litu and Don McLean Gill, thank you for joining the National Security Podcast.
Thanks very
much. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nari.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.